Hello and welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News. Groundwire is brought to you by volunteers at campus community radio stations across the country. I'm Leanne Arneson at CKUT in Montreal.
We want to say today, without fear or favor, that those that continue to impact on the planet, really the citizens of the world, the 99%, will continue to fight them. No matter where they are, we will fight them in every corner of the world, and we will hold them accountable, even with their corrupt governments.
Guelph police raided the Medical Cannabis Center of Guelph and charged four individuals. Charges have since been dropped against one of them.
They put the case together, and what happened was the federal government stepped in, and about a year later they stood up in court and stopped my prosecution.
In this episode of Groundwire, a recap after the Conference on Climate Change finishes in Durban, South Africa. Mary Carl Giao speaks with Scott Gilbert about the 2010 police raids on the Medical Cannabis Club in Guelph, Ontario. And lastly, Canada's failure to regulate environmental standards on Metro Vancouver's Iona sewage facility. First, the headlines.
Last Monday, Occupy Vancouver protesters staged their latest action. Protesters rallied outside of three Vancouver ports. The largest protest involved around 100 protesters. It lasted for only a short time and was policed by some 40 officers in full SWAT gear. Five protesters were arrested at a smaller protest earlier in the day. The Vancouver protests were in coordination with Occupy protests of ports up and down the West Coast. Protesters say that their actions are in solidarity with workers in Longview, Washington, who are currently locked out by their employer, EGT Grain Company. The Vancouver port protest, however, was contentious. The president of the BC Federation of Labour publicly appealed to the protesters not to carry out the action on the grounds that it would hurt BC workers and undermine the Occupy movement's popularity. Protesters told the Vancouver Sun that they heeded Jim Sinclair's appeal. They said that they had scaled down the protest and only protested the entrance of unionized workers who would be paid if they missed a day of work because of the protests. The Occupy Vancouver protest has been in a state of flux since it was ordered to leave its encampment at the Vancouver Art Gallery at the end of November. Protesters say that they continue to meet and are planning more civil actions. Joel Bard, reporting for Groundwire.
On December 1st, Sudanese-born Canadian Aboussfiane Abdulrazak's name was taken off of the UN Security Council terrorist blacklist. Abdulrazak views the move as a significant victory, as he has been battling the Canadian government over the allegations of terrorism for the past 10 years. In 2003, while Abdulrazak, a resident of Montreal, was visiting Sudan, he was jailed by the Sudanese government. The Canadian government had recommended this course of action. During his imprisonment, he was interrogated and tortured, but he was never charged. In 2006, while imprisoned in Sudan, he was added to the UN's 1267 person list of terror suspects. Abdulrazak was released from prison in 2007. He then took refuge in the Canadian embassy in Khartoum. He lived there for 14 months while his attempts to return to Canada were blocked by officials. After he was cleared of any charges by CSIS and the RCMP, he applied to be delisted from the UN list. The request was denied. In 2008, he went public with his story. The Canadian government at this point still refused him to grant travel documents, but he settled on a position that he could return home as long as he paid for the cost of his ticket. Canadian officials were aware that he lacked the money to do so, and as he was still on the UN watch list, under Canadian law, no Canadian could legally give him or loan him money to buy a ticket. After more than 160 Canadians risked prosecution and chipped in for airfare, the government reversed course and declared on April 3rd that Abdulrazak was a national security threat. Despite having the money to buy a ticket, the government refused him the travel documents he needed to board the flight. Meanwhile, Abdulrazak was making his way through the court system. In June 2009, the Federal Court of Canada found that Abdulrazak was originally arrested in Sudan on the request of CSIS, and that Lawrence Cannon acted illegally by preventing him from returning to Canada. The court ordered the Canadian government to bring him home without delay. And at the end of June 2009, he returned to his home in Montreal. After his return, the Canadian government continued to apply sanctions against him until he was delisted from the UN list on December 1st of this year. Even now that he has been delisted, his struggle is not over. Abdulrazak is trying to hold Canadian government officials accountable for their role in his imprisonment and torture in Sudan, and for whatever role they played in placing him on the UN blacklist. Abdulrazak is still in the process of rebuilding his life and his reputation. This is Ray Corcoran from CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal for Groundwire.
That was Chris Dirksen with a track called Smile With Me from the album The Cusp. And now it's time for the Community Radio Report.
The 10th annual Homelessness Marathon in Canada will be broadcast on over 30 stations around the country from sundown to sunup on February 22nd to the 23rd, 2012. Started in 2003, the Homelessness Marathon is a project of the National Campus Community Radio Association and will be simultaneously broadcast on member stations in nearly every province and territory. Rather than asking for charity, the marathon serves up 14 hours of live radio with the goals of consciousness raising and social change. It opens the mics to homeless people themselves and their allies so that they can talk about the issues which impact them directly. Like in past years, the marathon will be broadcast from the icy streets of Montreal in collaboration with the Native Friendship Center. CJSF Radio in Burnaby, BC, and CKDU Radio in Halifax will also host parts of the marathon from their respective cities. Listeners across the country will be invited to call in at any point during the marathon on a toll-free number to participate with questions or comments. Certain themes which will be featured on this year's marathon include housing on Aboriginal reserves, gender and housing, and the Pan-Canadian Occupy movement's reconfigurations of public space. Here is Andy, a former squatter in Montreal and one of the co-founders of the Homelessness Marathon, speaking on the first annual broadcast back in 2003.
There's no excuse why there should be homelessness, and there's no excuse why people should be going hungry in the city of Montreal. I'm here to make it known that all peoples, especially the street peoples and the homeless peoples, have a right to mass media and do have a right to say whatever they feel is right to get themselves into better living conditions and have the access to Medicare.
For more information, or to find out if your local campus community radio station will be airing the 2012 Homelessness Marathon, visit www.ckut.ca/homeless or email marathon@ckut.ca. This is Aaron Lakoff, the coordinator of the Homelessness Marathon for CKUT Radio in Montreal.
Since 1995, the Conference of Parties has brought together governments from all over the world to find solutions for climate change. In 1997, the Kyoto Protocol established legally binding obligations for developed countries to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. This year, parties came together for the 17th conference in Durban, South Africa, to work on a new international treaty to limit carbon emissions. While COP17 President Mary Nkwana Mashabane speaks at the end of the conference about great progress, Drew Ojeje, a Montreal-based journalist who was in Durban during the conference, draws a different conclusion.
That we're not going to see an agreement that actually addresses the problem. You know, climate change is a global problem. It's going to have massive impacts. Just looking at Africa alone, where the conference is held, you have millions of people that are vulnerable to famine if we have the kind of droughts that scientists are predicting we would have, you know, if the median temperature keeps going up. So it's really the poorest people in the world who are going to be the most affected by this. And nothing really is being done to address that. I mean, arguably, we've already passed the point of no return, but what we're doing is accelerating toward the cliff here as opposed to trying to slow down and turn around. And that trend has simply continued at this climate conference. I think they're going to try and put a happy face on it. They're going to try and say that some progress has been made.
Canada became subject of international attention at this year's conference for pulling out of the Kyoto Protocol and received a lot of criticism on national and international level.
In the lead up to the conference, Canada was revealed in Canadian newspapers that Canada had planned to pull out of Kyoto. And a number of different observers accused Canada of poisoning the talks by announcing in the prelude to the talks that they were going to pull out of this agreement. So it sort of went downhill from there. Canada was accused of trying to buy off developing countries with aid money. It was accused of defending the tar sands and the massive emissions that will result if that industry continues to expand the way it has been. It was accused of being part of the problem in terms of blocking any kind of binding agreement from being signed. Obviously, the U.S. is the main culprit there in the sense that they're traditionally the country that wields the most power, but I think Canada has in many ways taken over the role of being the most extreme in sabotaging any kind of agreement from being signed. I think that there's a pretty universal understanding, and I think it was helped along quite a bit by the constant on the daily actions, helping to draw attention to Canada's really retrogressive role in with regard to the climate talks.
The Canadian Minister of Environment, Peter Kent, however, defends Canada's position of withdrawing from the Kyoto Protocol, which in his view has been a failure.
Canada went to Durban in a spirit of goodwill. We went committed to being constructive. The Durban platform is a way forward that builds on our work at Copenhagen and at Cancun. The Kyoto Protocol does not represent the path forward for Canada. The Kyoto Protocol does not cover the world's two largest emitters, the United States and China, and therefore cannot work. We are invoking Canada's legal right to formally withdraw from Kyoto. We remain committed to negotiating an international climate change agreement that works. This means getting a pact that involves all major emitters.
It is not clear, though, how Canada wants to achieve lower emissions. Also, Canada houses the largest industrial project in the world, the tar sands, which is a lucrative but heavily polluting project. Desmond Tsa, a leading climate activist from the South Durban Community Environmental Alliance, accuses the governments for preventing any progress against the climate change by only following their national and economic interests. In his view, it's not the governments, but it's the 99% who can make a change.
We have to say today that the conference is a failure. It has wasted the resources that could have been used to bring about relief in the world. We want to say today, without fear or favor, that those that continue to impact on the planet, we, the citizens of the world, the 99%, will continue to fight them. No matter where they are, we will fight them in every corner of the world, and we will hold them accountable, even with their corrupt governments. We want to say to them today, our hope lies in what we saw as a global movement, united and speaking in one voice. That is the way forward for us as citizens of the world. We will continue to build on that. We will continue to strengthen that, because that will save our families, protect the generations now and those in the future. So I say, down with the governments that are corrupt, down with those who support the polluters, down with those who are not against the citizens of the world, down.
Reporting for Groundwire, this was Verena Utner from CKUT.
Hi, I'm Mary Carl Giao, reporting for Groundwire. Today we have Scott Gilbert from the Hamilton Medical Marijuana Center on our Groundwire community radio program. Scott was previously a resident of Guelph, Ontario, and former employee at the Medical Cannabis Club of Guelph, which was raided by City Police in 2010. Scott is here today to speak with us about the context of the case and what has happened since within Guelph, Ontario. Could you tell us a bit about your involvement with the Guelph dispensary?
In 2007, I applied for a job at the Medical Cannabis Club of Guelph. It was an entry-level position where I would be processing applications for new patients that would come through the door. And I worked there for about 3 years until the organization moved to a larger location in January of 2010. There was a front-page news article on the launch of the club, which generated a lot of attention, as well as we started running bus ads.
What happened when police raided?
In May 2010, the Guelph police decided to test the admission system at the Medical Cannabis Club of Guelph. They submitted applications that included the real last name of a medical practitioner, but a fake first name. They did this to try to be able to enter the club and purchase cannabis under the auspices of being a sick person. When clinic staff followed company protocol to phone the doctor to verify that they had in fact authorized the use of medical cannabis for the patient, the clinic staff ended up speaking with an undercover agent down at the Guelph Police Headquarters instead of to a medical practitioner like they thought they were. What happened over the course of the next few weeks is the officers came in on multiple occasions and made several purchases, never more than 28 grams or 1 ounce at a time. But what they wanted to do was rack up multiple charges. And so on the 6th of May, I believe it was 2010, Guelph police raided the Medical Cannabis Center of Guelph and charged four individuals. Charges have since been dropped against one of them. But the owner, as well as two staff members, one of which is myself, remain on charges well over a year later. At present, the status of the charges is that we're fighting them on constitutional grounds. And since the raid, actually, one of the head officers involved with the case, who is involved in doing the warrants, is now himself on drug charges. Actually, the Guelph police announced that they had arrested a member of their own force. All they described it as was a theft of material evidence from a drug locker. And they charged the officer with breach of trust and theft under $5,000. These are incredibly serious allegations, and there's many unanswered questions, such as what were the type of drugs that were stolen, and what did the officer intend to do with them? The lay observer would suggest that they were either for consumption or to distribute, but it's also important to know what type of drugs they were. Was this crack or was it cocaine? The charges that were laid, I mean, there must have been considerable evidence of wrongdoing, yet the police force is clearly protecting their own by offering watered-down charges.
What can be done to address this type of police misconduct?
One of the things that I'm suggesting should happen here is that the Guelph police should all have to undergo regular drug testing. As one of our bail terms required, we were unable to consume any drugs outside of the context of a medical prescription.
Has drug testing of police officers happened in other cities?
When this happened in Toronto, several members of the drug squad in Toronto were caught breaching the public trust, and the chief of police actually commissioned a report to see what could be done to restore confidence by the public. Police Chief Fantino hired the late Judge Honorable George Ferguson, and the report that was commissioned dealt with drug trafficking, shakedowns, etc., a number of allegations that were made against Toronto police officers. At the end of the report, Judge Ferguson made 32 recommendations, many of which would be relevant here in Guelph, including a call for officers to undergo mandatory drug testing, as they already do in New York City. And this is particularly before they are promoted or transferred to, quote, sensitive or high-risk units such as the drug squad or emergency task force. After the report was issued, Judge Ferguson attended a Toronto City Council meeting and said the following. Be assured that throughout the world, including Toronto, there have been far too many lengthy reports and recommendations relating to police misconduct and corruption that have gathered dust or been ignored with drastic consequences resulting therefrom.
So how do your current charges play into the coming regulation changes to the medical marijuana program?
I would just like to comment that, what the Guelph police charged us with doing, what we were doing is actually the same as what Health Canada is now recommending as improvements to the regulatory framework that are going to be released in 2014. In 2014, what they're going to do is have private companies that would confirm the diagnosis of a patient independently with a licensed medical practitioner and exclude Health Canada from the situation, specifically to increase wait times and improve patient care. And this is what the Medical Cannabis Club of Guelph was doing prior to the raids, and what we continue to remain on charges for, and yet this is our model is now being adopted by Health Canada and is going to be implemented on a national scale, and we continue to fight the charges at the local level, at least. Another thing that's coming up is Bill C-10, and this is part of the omnibus crime package that the Harper government is going to be passing in the very near future. It calls for mandatory minimum sentences for many drug-related offenses, including cultivation of marijuana. And so this is what we're going to see here is a combination of Bill C-10 coming in and making it much more dangerous to be involved in the marijuana industry, as well as at the same time, Health Canada is going to make it even easier to apply for a federal permit to possess marijuana. So I think what we're going to see on a national scale is a large number of people applying for the federal program specifically to get themselves out of the implications of Bill C-10. And so these are two different independent federal initiatives, both of which are going to essentially have a positive feedback loop off each other.
Thank you, Scott, for coming on the program. Do you have any final words?
Well, anyway, thank you, Mary, for inviting me to speak about this on CFRU Radio. And I would just encourage anyone, if they'd like to learn more about this, they can contact me at the Hamilton Medical Marijuana Center. We're located at 833 King Street East in Hamilton. And our website is www.hamiltonmm.ca. Thank you very much.
I was just speaking with Scott Gilbert from the Hamilton Medical Marijuana Center. Scott was previously a resident of Guelph and former employee at the Medical Cannabis Club of Guelph, which was raided by city police in 2010. Scott was talking about the context of the case and what has been happening since in Guelph. I'm Mary Carl Giao reporting for Groundwire.
The Onis sewage facility is located in Richmond, just north of the Vancouver International Airport. 47% of Metro Vancouver's sewage is discharged at Iona. On average, the Iona sewage plant discharges 552 million liters of sewage every day into the marine environment of the Strait of Georgia. According to Parks Canada, the Strait of Georgia is the most at-risk natural environments in Canada.
On an annual basis, they discharged 17 tons of copper every year, 13 tons of hydrogen sulfide, 838 kilograms of lead, and they also discharge mercury and PCBs. And
Doug Chapman, a former environmental prosecutor for the province of Ontario and member of the Fraser River Keepers, began gathering evidence and commenced a private prosecution against Metro Vancouver as a result of a Yonah sewage facility.
Metro Vancouver has a permit from the province that requires them to, on a monthly basis, to conduct a toxicity test to see if the what they're discharging is toxic to fish, and found that on a regular basis it was toxic to fish. They couldn't pass the test. And so we charged them under the Federal Fisheries Act. Citizens can bring private prosecutions in this country. And what happened was, and I'm a former prosecutor with the government myself, an environmental prosecutor. I worked for the Ontario government for many years. So I put the case together, and what happened was the federal government stepped in, and about a year later they stood up in court and stopped my prosecution. Now, I could prove that the environmental crimes were happening. I could prove that the federal government warned them that these were crimes and that they were going to charge them. Of course, they never did. That's why I took it upon myself to do that. And but they stopped my prosecution. And of course, right after that, for several months, the crimes continued. And in fact, they continued as recently as June, July, and August of this year, 2011. They're still happening.
After the federal government had stayed the charges against Yonah, effectively allowing it to continue to break the law, Fraser River Keeper, as well as other organizations such as the David Suzuki Foundation, prepared a complaint to the CEC, the Committee on Environmental Cooperation, in 2010.
Canada and the United States and Mexico entered into their free trade agreement years and years ago. Part of that agreement called for a Commission for Environmental Cooperation, and it's an organization that before which any citizen can complain that one of these three countries, Mexico, U.S., or Canada, are not enforcing their environmental laws. And so we brought a complaint before this body, and it was just yesterday that they ruled that they accepted our complaint and that they're going to call on federal government to explain why they are not enforcing the law.
The Yonah outfall is near the mouth of the Fraser River, which supports some of North America's most important commercial, Aboriginal, and recreational salmon fisheries. Roughly 1 billion juvenile salmon pass through the mouth of the Fraser River every year.
This discharge of this improperly treated sewage is right at the mouth of the Fraser River. All the fish returning salmon have to swim through it. And the little babies have to swim through it on their way out to sea. You know, they come back 4 years later. When they go out, they're just like an inch long. They all have to swim through this.
You have been listening to Groundwire Community Radio News. Thank you to all our volunteers from coast to coast. I'm Leanne Arneson at CKUT in Montreal.